phone and that tells them that you're home, because I've noticed on many occasions if I talk on the phone very much, which I don't as a rule, I don't use the phone a lot, but if I do, when I hang up within that half hour following, I'm starting to get a number of spam calls. So to me, it indicates that they know that I'm home and they really stop barraging me with these calls. So that's
interesting.
Technology now is like, it's hard to keep up with it, how fast it's progressing.
Yeah,
definitely. Well, thank you for that. And be monitoring and kind of being conscious of you know, when you're getting them and stuff like that. That's interesting. Got a lot of really good information. And we are going to be putting it up on the website. That's kboo.fm. And we are, looks like we're about done with our hour here. It was really awesome. Thank you everyone for calling in and listening. I'm Tammy. This is The Gap. On the line with me is my better half, Althea, and in the studio, the one and only Sonia.
The better third.
Any last? Thank you all so much. Have a fantastic weekend. Take care.
Thanks all.
And that's it. Take care. See ya.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio has been chosen to be part of Give Guide by Willamette Week. When you show your support for KBOO on Give Guide or any of the other 170 participating organizations with a minimum $10 donation, you'll be thanked with full access to hundreds of local coupons in the Chinook Book mobile app, plus a few other goodies. Help us reach our Give Guide goal, and don't forget that all new and increased donations will be matched up to $25,000. Give Guide and this offer ends on December 31st, so donate today at kboo.fm/give.
Hi everyone, I'm Karen James from Prison Pipeline. On December 21st, we'll broadcast your holiday messages to and from your loved ones in prison. Write your holiday message or record your voice using Zoom and email your message to kboppc@gmail.com. Then tune in to Prison Pipeline on December 21st to hear your holiday messages to your loved one. Again, send those written or recorded messages to kboppc@gmail.com. And from all of us at Prison Pipeline, stay safe, be well, and all the best during this holiday season.
Statements by government that we are equal and that mistreatment of us is wrong and contrary to the law, that's a very powerful part of changing those attitudes. I mean, ultimately, what we're looking for is the opportunity for everybody to have a full and safe life and opportunity without discrimination on a range of grounds, including LGBTQ status.
Welcome to Sprouts from Pacifica, radio from the grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio productions by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience, produced by a different local station or independent producer each week. This week, we present Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting is produced in New York by Media for the Public Good, online at outcastingmedia.org. Hi, I'm Lucas. There are some religious people, congregations, and religions that support LGBTQ people. In the Episcopal Church, Bishop Gene Robinson was the first openly gay bishop, but his consecration led to a worldwide split in the church over the issue of homosexuality. In New York City, Congregation Beit Simchat Torah is an LGBTQ welcoming synagogue with an openly gay leader, Rabbi Sharon Kleinbaum. Both Bishop Gene and Rabbi Kleinbaum were guests on earlier editions of Outcasting. you can listen to their interviews on our website, outcastingmedia.org. But historically, many religions have condemned LGBTQ people. The Catholic Church has described homosexuality as an intrinsic disorder and encouraged people to condemn the sin, not the sinner, as if people can just rip sexuality out of their lives without inflicting great harm on themselves. Any number of religious counselors continue to practice conversion or reparative therapy to cure people of being gay, even as a growing number of states and even some other countries recognize that this treatment is ineffective and potentially dangerous. We did a series in early 2020 on conversion therapy. It's also available at outcastingmedia.org. As the law is catching up with the growing public acceptance of LGBTQ people, and as we have secured a number of important civil rights, there's a movement determined to put us firmly back in our place, as they would have it. Cake shops and florists claim that they're entitled to deny their services to us because they say that providing services to LGBTQ people would violate their religious liberty. This discrimination would never be seen as legitimate if it were directed at any other minority group. Just imagine it. A shop owner says, "My religious liberty prevents me from serving black people or Jewish people, so go away." It's unthinkable that that would be seen as acceptable in today's world. And of course there are businesses where the stakes would be much higher if it becomes the law that businesses can just turn away LGBTQ people based on a religious objection. So, is there any legitimacy when a business owner cites religious liberty to justify denying service to LGBTQ people? What are the contours of religious liberty? What's supposed to happen when someone, citing religious liberty, discriminates against LGBTQ people, thus denying their equality? What does equality mean in the United States? Does one take precedence over the other when equality and religious liberty come into conflict? This is the second part of our conversation with Jennifer C. Pizer. Jenny is the Senior Counsel and Director of Law and Policy for Lambda Legal, the country's oldest and largest legal organization seeking full recognition of the civil rights of LGBT people and everyone living with HIV. Jenny, welcome back to Outcasting.
Lucas, it's a pleasure. So good to be with you.
When we left off last time, we were talking about the movement to elevate religious liberty above the right to equality so that people and businesses can use their religious beliefs to justify discrimination against LGBTQ people in ways that wouldn't be allowed for other minorities. And you reminded us that the United States isn't a theocracy, that we have a secular government that provides not only freedom of religion, but also freedom from religion, and that each of us should have the same basic rights under the civil law. So, moving ahead, do you think that religious liberty can coexist peacefully with LGBTQ equality, or does one or the other have to be limited?
Well, yes, absolutely. Religious liberty can coexist peacefully with LGBT equality in the same way that religious liberty can and has coexisted peacefully with equality for women and for racial justice. If we think back, one of the Supreme Court cases that we cite frequently now, and in fact the Supreme Court cited in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case a couple of years ago about the Christian baker that didn't want to make a cake, a wedding cake for same-sex couple, the Supreme Court cited a case that was about sincere religious beliefs that the races should be separate and that a barbecue restaurant, a chain of barbecue restaurants owned by white people, had a religious responsibility to refuse to seat black guests. They would only serve barbecue on a takeout basis for African-American guests. That was their sincere religious belief, and the Supreme Court recognized, well, that belief is protected, but if you're operating a business, you have to follow the law. The law says we're not having racial segregation. We'll protect your right to believe as you wish, but not to act based on that belief in a way that's discriminatory. So our society has grappled with this question repeatedly before and has developed a framework that works quite well. I mean, we saw the same issue a number of years ago when there were some commercial landlords that refused to rent apartments to unmarried different sex couples. These were cases in which the landlord claimed a right to not follow the fair housing law because of a sincere religious belief that different sex couples who might have sex with each other outside marriage, they should not live together, and a landlord should not be complicit in what that religious belief deemed to be a sin by renting that apartment. And the courts came to the correct and consistent conclusion that that belief on the part of the landlord is protected, but not the act of discriminating in rental housing. So it's not new. However, we have seen, as the marriage equality work had more and more success, and as it looked as though we were likely to ultimately prevail, we saw not just a few, but actually hundreds of proposals in state legislatures across the country to create legal permission to act based on religion in a way that would discriminate against same-sex couples. Most of those proposals were stopped, I'm happy to say, but there was quite a fervent effort on the part of those who opposed marriage equality to create this religion-based permission to discriminate. Another way of thinking of it might be, well, if the courts allow this new legal protection for same-sex couples, this new legal recognition for same-sex couples, people operating some of these businesses wanted the freedom to not follow that new rule. And for the most part, we were able to oppose those proposals, stop them from becoming law. But it is certainly an ongoing conversation, an ongoing contest, really. And there are quite a few cases in the courts now that are testing whether the balance should continue to be the same. The court decisions that have been issued going back now a number of decades, quite a few decades, whether that gives us the correct answer when it comes to the tension between religious freedom and LGBT equality, as we saw in cases about sex discrimination, race discrimination, and marital status discrimination. We think the answer should be the same. That's certainly the position we're litigating in these cases. And the Supreme Court has yet to give us a complete and final definitive answer, although there was some quite important good language in the Masterpiece Cake Shop decision.
So now, without getting yet into recent developments, say the past 10 years, let's start by defining what the actual interests are in the situation. Let's start specifically with the right not to be discriminated against. What is the constitutional basis for that?
Well, the Equal Protection Clause is the most important protection. That's in the 14th Amendment. That's one of the amendments that was put in place after the Civil War. Now, there's a similar equality right in state constitutions as well. And sometimes that state constitutional right is a bit broader than the federal right. Both sources of equality protection are terribly important.
Can you explain how that works and why it hasn't yet made us LGBTQ people truly equal?
Well, the place to start is that the Supreme Court held back in the late 1800s that the Constitution only applies against the government. It doesn't apply in the private sector. So each equality movement has had to get statutes passed, laws passed, to require equal treatment in the private sector. So that is like, for example, I was mentioning this federal law about employment that was passed in 1964. That law covers discrimination based on race, color, national origin, sex, or religion. And that applies to employers that are big enough, and it creates a framework for how we decide whether discrimination is actually happening on one of those forbidden bases. We've had to develop the legal arguments to get the courts to understand that discrimination based on a person's sexual orientation has to be understood as a form of sex discrimination, that sexual orientation discrimination is a relational idea. Let's say I'm working in a job setting, and my boss learns that I'm dating a man. That's just fine if I'm seen as a woman. But if I'm seen as a man dating another man, the boss doesn't like that. Well, the cause of the boss's unhappiness is my sex with respect to the person I'm dating. In other words, sexual orientation is a relational concept. It can't be understood without referring to sex. So it's sex discrimination. The Supreme Court did a similar analysis in the case about gender identity. That was about whether the person's sex is understood from the perspective of the boss or from the perspective of the worker, and the boss not approving of the sex of the worker. The federal law promises that we're to be treated equally in the workplace without regard to those personal characteristics. So we've had to do the work in states and at the federal level to get those statutory protections, because the Constitution, which is incredibly important, doesn't reach those areas in the private sector. I will say, though, we have won important victories in court and important progress in interacting with the government based on the Constitution. In fact, winning the freedom to marry involved litigating based on the Constitution. And when we challenge the government about the military policy, for example, or other ways that the government treats us, we refer to the Constitution, and there is important protection for LGBT people in the Equal Protection Clause.
So what's the constitutional basis for religious liberty?
Well, that's the First Amendment. The First Amendment religion clauses that protect both the freedom to exercise religion and a freedom from having the government establish or prefer a particular religion over other religions, or religion in general over non-religion. And we have similar protections for religion in state constitutions as well. And there are also special protections for religion in lots of laws. In Title VII, the federal law about workplace discrimination, there's a special requirement that employers provide special accommodations for workers who have certain religious needs. Now, that's not an enormous burden on the employer. It's a duty to accommodate, and it only goes so far, but it's an example of special protection for religious interests that exist in some statutes, as well as the constitutional protection. The constitutional protection, again, just relates to how the government treats us. So sometimes there are statutory protections that protect religion that govern the private sector.
Is there any particular importance to religious liberty being in the First Amendment and equal protection being in the Fifth and 14th?
No, that is something that we sometimes hear from people who believe that religious liberty should surmount all the other interests and dominate over all the other rights. But that's not actually how the Constitution works. All of those rights are considered to be fundamental, to be essential and incredibly important. And it's the job of the courts sometimes, and also the rest of us, to understand how they should relate to each other. For example, if you were on trial, the right to trial by jury and the other protections for how you're treated as a criminal defendant would be the most important rights to you in that context. And if you're in some other context, then the protections that apply in that context would be the most important ones. The rights of speech and to petition the government and freedom of religion, they certainly were considered very important by the founders. But so were these other rights. I mean, the right to not have the government or police invading your home without a proper warrant or proper cause, that's an incredibly important freedom. The founders certainly thought that was just as important. So it doesn't matter what the number is. They're all protected by the Constitution, and the courts figure out how they should relate to each other when there's a perceived conflict between them.
This is Sprouts from Pacifica. This week featuring Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting is produced in New York by Media for the Public Good, online at outcastingmedia.org. We're talking about what happens when people claim that their religious liberty entitles them to discriminate against LGBTQ people in ways that wouldn't be acceptable if the discrimination were against other minorities. Our guest is Jenny Pizer, the Senior Counsel and Director of Law and Policy for Lambda Legal, the country's oldest and largest legal organization seeking full recognition of the civil rights of LGBT people and everyone living with HIV. So we've been talking mainly about courts. Let's turn to legislation. There are federal, state, county, and local laws that protect LGBTQ people from discrimination. Tell us about some of them.
Well, I'll start by saying that they vary quite a lot. They vary in what they cover. They vary in the enforcement provisions that they have, the remedies that they provide, and also how clear and understandable they are. State laws cover quite a lot. Local laws usually have a lot less power to regulate. At this point, roughly half the states have strong civil rights protections for LGBT people. Then in some of the states that don't have a state law, there are local protections. Local governments often have more authority to control public spaces. Often they don't have the authority to regulate things like employment. So one of the challenges that we have is that there can be quite a bit of confusion if the laws vary from city to city or county to county, and even from state to state. that's part of why we put quite a priority on eventually being able to pass consistent laws at the federal level so everybody has protection and everybody knows what those protections are.
So when we were talking several years ago with Evan Wilson about marriage equality in an earlier episode of Outcasting, and this was before the Obergefell case in 2015, which made marriage equality the law of the land, he said that people's right to be married and all that entails flickered in and out like cell phone service as they crossed state lines. With the state and local laws, do we have that same situation? We're protected from discrimination in one jurisdiction, but the protection flickers out when we cross the border into another jurisdiction?
Yes, that's exactly what we have. And that's part of why it can be so confusing. People do sometimes say, what's the point of having local laws in particular if the protections are limited both in scope and also in just that particular geography, which might be quite small? I do think those protections are important, even if the practical impact is somewhat limited, because they can be an important statement of welcome and a statement of community values and how people are expected to treat each other. That's part of why people sometimes work so hard to enact protections at the local level. And sometimes they do that as a statement encouraging businesses to come or insisting that it's important to pass those laws so that a business will come, because it's a statement that all of the employees of that business would be welcome, all the guests would be welcome, that the local government intends to make that a welcoming environment. I think that all is quite important. At the same time, the reality is that those rights, as a practical matter, they just exist within those local jurisdictions, and often it's confusing how to use them, and sometimes they don't actually provide that much in the way of a remedy. So the state laws provide a lot more, and then ultimately the federal law is what makes a national commitment that people will be treated fairly and will have real remedies if their rights are violated.
So aside from the practical impact, why is that symbolism so important to LGBTQ people?
Well, an important part of the change that we all are working toward is a changed social understanding of whether there's something wrong with us, whether we should be welcomed and included in society, or whether we should be stigmatized and shunned and excluded. Among the challenges that I think we've made a lot of progress about over, you know, the recent decades is people coming out and letting the rest of society know who we are and dispelling a lot of the myths about who we are. But the social stigma can be so damaging, and it causes so much anguish within families if parents feel that they have failed because it turns out that their child is LGBTQ. Maybe the child is gender nonconforming or whatever it may be, and parents feel that this is wrong, or maybe there is condemnation within their faith community. So statements by government, at whatever level of government, that we are equal and that mistreatment of us is wrong and contrary to the law, that's a very powerful part of changing those attitudes. I mean, ultimately, what we're looking for is the opportunity for everybody to have a full and safe life and opportunity. It's not that we want everybody to have legal claims and spend their lives in courts litigating about things. I mean, at Lambda Legal, we litigate. It's an important part of what we do, and we take up cases. But ultimately, the society that we're trying to achieve is one where people are treated properly. So changing attitudes is key to that, and laws and policies are an important reflection of the values that are to govern in a particular space, whether it's a public law or ordinance or whether it's the policy of a private employer. They're all important in giving the guidance about how we are to treat each other and the respect that is deserved by each person without discrimination on a range of grounds, including LGBTQ status.
So there is a law called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or RFRA. What was going on in the United States that spurred its enactment? Had religious freedom been restrained, and why did it need to be restored?
Religious Freedom Restoration Act, not so affectionately sometimes called RFRA. What happened was that there was a case that was decided by the Supreme Court in 1990. The name of the case was Employment Division against Smith, And it was a case about a Native American man who had been using peyote, and he was fired from his job. There was a lawsuit about whether he was entitled to unemployment benefits. And ultimately, it made its way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court changed the legal test. Now, we had had a legal test that gave special protection to religious rights. It used a test where it looked about whether a person's religious freedom was being burdened by a law. If it was being substantially burdened, then the government had to have a compelling interest to enforce the law, and the law couldn't be too broad. It was a technical legal test. And in the Smith decision, the court really changed the analysis. And it's interesting. This was a decision written by Justice Scalia, the late Justice Scalia, a very conservative jurist. But his view here was that if religion was not being targeted, and it was just a neutral, religiously neutral law that applied to everybody the same way, no unequal treatment of people based on religion, that everybody has to follow the law. So that really would make it much easier for government to function. So Justice Scalia was quite passionate about religious rights, but he also felt that government should have the right to operate, to pass laws, no religious targeting, but in essence, no special treatment. If there's a law that applies to everybody, everybody should follow it. Many people in society and in Congress thought that that decision was incorrect, and they passed this Religious Freedom Restoration Act. So what they were restoring was the idea of special rights for religion and a special legal test that required the government to have extra strong reasons to enforce a law if doing so would burden somebody's religion.
Now, that may sound very good, but is it code language? Does the RFRA hide something dangerous while looking like something good? Or has that evolved over time?
Well, when the Religious Freedom Restoration Act was being considered in Congress, it had broad support across the political spectrum of religious conservatives on the one hand, the ACLU on the other hand, quite a few different groups with different views about religion, all thought it was appropriate to reinstate this heightened protection for religion. But your question is quite insightful. The fact is that people had different ideas about how this legal test should work. And actually, a profound change was brought about by the Supreme Court just a couple of years ago in a decision that folks may remember hearing about called Hobby Lobby. This was a case in which the Supreme Court really changed the elements of the test. It was a case about whether a part of the Affordable Care Act that requires employers to include birth control insurance coverage in the employee's health insurance coverage, if an employer had a religious objection to including that birth control coverage, could they object? So there's a federal law, the Affordable Care Act, requiring employers to provide this insurance. Some employers objected, and the Supreme Court said, under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the employer was burdened. The government maybe has a good reason for requiring that insurance, but they could provide the insurance another way, and so the employer doesn't have to provide it. And on the way to getting to that conclusion, the different elements of the test were really reinterpreted in some ways that create some quite serious potential implications moving forward. So I would say the current test has become grossly distorted from the way it started out. And that really does pose a problem for us moving forward.
And you noted that this is a federal law. Are there any state versions?
Well, there are some state versions. Actually, what happened was the Supreme Court decided in 1997 that the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act could not be applied against the states for various reasons about the way we do constitutional analysis. And after that decision, a number of states did enact their own versions of RFRA. The names vary a little bit, the Religious Freedom Protection Act, Religious Liberty Protection Act, you know, but along the same lines. And some of those state laws actually go farther than what the federal law does. Sometimes they explicitly said that those rights can be invoked by private parties in their own private disputes. Doesn't have to involve government. That's one example. So there is some variety, and then some states considered enacting laws of that sort and decided against it. There's still the possibility in some states, and I'll use California as an example because I'm sitting here in beautiful Los Angeles right now. The California legislature did not pass a law of that sort, but the California Supreme Court has not yet answered the question that the Supreme Court answered in the Smith case by Justice Alito. In other words, the California Constitution might well require the kind of strict scrutiny analysis, that's what we call this complicated test, the California Constitution might require that as a matter of state constitutional law. We don't know. So the bottom line is sometimes we have statutory protections at the federal level, sometimes they're at the state level. Sometimes we have constitutional protections at the federal level, sometimes they're at the state level. They all can vary, and they all get invoked in some of these disputes by people who, for religious reasons, want to be able to continue to discriminate against LGBT people, even when we've succeeded in getting protections in state law or in federal law.
We've run out of time, but we'll continue this conversation on the next edition of Outcasting. Thanks for joining us, Jenny.
Thanks so much, Lucas. It's been fun.
That's it for this second part of our series on the conflict between equality for LGBTQ people and those who cite religious liberty to justify discriminating against us. If you've missed any of the series, it's available on our website, outcastingmedia.org. This program has been produced by the Outcasting team, including youth participants Sarah, Chris, Lil, Justin, Brian, and me, Lucas. Our executive producer is Mark Sofis. Outcasting is produced in New York by Media for the Public Good. More information is available at outcastingmedia.org. You'll find information about the show, listen links for all Outcasting content, and the podcast link. Outcasting is also on social media. Connect with us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at Outcasting Media. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country, bringing you local radio productions of national interest. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. If you or someone at your radio station has a production that you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Lucas. Thank you for listening. See you next time on Sprouts.
Good morning. This is Disability Justice, an everyday pursuit and survival. Your host, John Griffiths.
Today we are interviewing Shanya Luther, the founder and director of Amongst Friends. Welcome, Shanya.
Thank you so much for having me, John.
So I would like to start off with asking you, how did you get started in this business?
I was studying in my undergraduate work, I was studying everything to do with counseling, you know, everything to do with counseling, maybe as a, was thinking maybe I'd be a marriage and family therapist or something like that. Toward the end of my time in undergraduate school, I learned that my school offered a special certificate in sexuality education and being able to teach people about sexuality and healthy sexual development. And so I got a special certificate when I left undergraduate degree. I had a special certificate in that. And then I actually ended up going to seminary after that and studied to become a pastor. And every project that I could do on sexuality and spirituality, I did.
Can I ask you, what faith were you studying to become a minister for?
I was actually studying to become a pastor in the United Church of Christ, which is a relatively progressive Protestant denomination.
Oftentimes, you know, the subject of sex is a very taboo subject.
For me, I knew how much damage the church had done to people around their identities of, you know, their sexual orientation or their sexual identity or their, you know, healing or trauma or any of that stuff. And so I knew how much healing needed to be done. And at the time, I thought I would do sexuality education in the context of faith-based communities. You know, I really believed that that's where I was going to do that work.
So it's obviously led to some unique opportunities.
Absolutely. In fact, oh, and I should finish telling you how I got into this field. So I ended up opening a private practice after I left seminary, and you know, did some odd jobs, but I finally opened a private practice. And then I also took a side job helping people with developmental diversity do activities of daily living. You know, I just wanted to have a little bit of predictable income. And so I thought, well, let me do something that's meaningful. And pretty soon the families of the folks that I was supporting were like, oh, wait a minute, I'm sorry, you're a sexuality educator? Oh no, you can stop. We don't want you to ever help our you know, child or loved one. We don't bother with grocery shopping. Don't bother with, you know, fixing food. Don't bother with bank accounts. Like, we need you to talk to them about sex. And so I went back to my supervisor and I said, you know, I'm capable of this. I'm certainly qualified. I said, but it's not in my contract, you know? And she said, well, you know, there's a way that you can do that. There's a specialty under the state that you can do that. And I said, no, I don't know anything about that. And so lo and behold, that's what led me to discover behavior supports around sexuality and healthy sexual development. Hmm. And the specialty she talked about wasn't specifically about sexual development, but it was about behavior supports. And then I just took my own expertise into that and developed social sexual behavior supports.
So what is your background and what services do you offer?
Well, so some of my background is that I did study to do counseling, and then I went and got a seminary degree. So it's called a Master's of Divinity, which gave me a lot of information about religious studies. And the nice thing about that, Don, is that it helps me understand people's religious values around sex and sexuality. So that is often a great conversation starter also when I'm talking with folks. But then I ended up, I worked for a domestic violence agency for a little bit. And as I say, I started a private practice. So all of that is kind of what led me into this work. I've also done continuing education for over, you know, 20 years, you know, learning, going to workshops, learning new things, taking classes. So I keep teaching myself new things because it's important, or I go learn them from someone else. And I would say the services that we offer at this point among friends at this point are what are called professional behavior services through the state of Oregon. And that means that we conduct a functional behavior assessment. We end up writing a formal behavior support plan, a positive behavior support plan. And then sometimes we do what's called ongoing supports. And all of that is to help people make sure that they stay safe, healthy, legal, you know, and then that they don't get into any trouble or find themselves in any situations that they don't want to be in. But more importantly, it's about helping people set goals and where do they want to go and what do they want for themselves. Oh, and we also have private pay consultation. So if people, for example, either don't receive you know, services through the state of Oregon Department of Developmental Disability Services, they could have an hour or two of our time to help them understand some things or think about some things or create some strategies or get some resources. And so there's a lot of different ways that we can support people if they want.
You know, I'm kind of like curious, you said help people set goals.
Yes.
And when you say goals, is that like goals for dating, or is that goals for like maybe finding a hooker, or is that goals for like hey, I don't want to wind up in jail or something else like that? You know what I'm saying? These, of course, those few examples I gave out are kind of broad and all over the place, but you know, I mean, can you like really kind of like define some more of the services?
Absolutely. Yeah. So the you kind of hit the nail on the head. It is so broad, right? I mean, I've supported somebody who wanted to have gender reassignment surgery, and we worked on a plan to help them figure out how to proceed with gender reassignment surgery. I've supported somebody who wanted to learn how to cross dress. and wanted to supports on how to go pick out clothing. I've supported people who have wanted to go and pick out a sex toy or have some kind of device that they could use when they were by themselves. I've also supported a lot of people who wanted to learn how to date or have, you know, a possible romantic or sexual partner and wanted to set goals around that and try to work toward that outcome. I've supported people who were engaging in non-consensual touch and needed to be taught, you know, how to make sure that they ask for consent and that they only ask in the places that aren't going to get them in trouble or to the people that aren't going to get them in trouble. I've supported people who didn't understand how their behavior online was going to get them in trouble or could get them in danger, you know? When you say it so broad, it is absolutely so broad because there's so many different things that are related to sexuality and sexual development and relationships. And, you know, as you say, maybe somebody's looking to engage with someone for paid sex work, or maybe somebody's looking to, you know, find a kind of a friends with benefits situation. But then we have other people who just want a traditional, you know, they just want to find a traditional partner, get married and have some kids, right? And it's everything under the sun. All of those things are true.
And I mean, okay, so as a business that deals kind of in the area of sex,
mm-hmm.
Obviously there's got to be some legal barriers.
Mm-hmm.
And some gray areas, and it's just kind of like, do you ever have a fear of when somebody wants to do something that helps them out but that is presently illegal?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's such an interesting balancing act, right? Because first and foremost, people deserve information. And so, you know, they deserve accurate information. They deserve all the information, not just what's easy or fun or convenient, you know. They deserve to know all of the possible negative consequences, but they also deserve all the possible positive consequences of their actions, you know. So in that sense, if somebody wants to pursue something that is technically illegal, my job is to provide them with lots of information to make sure that they understand that it's illegal, right? And that they understand what that could possibly lead to, and that they feel like they make informed choices. The other thing that I think is really valuable about the work that we do at Among Friends, and that if anybody else is considering doing work like this, is that I think it's best to have a team-based approach. Because if you have a team-based approach, no one person is taking on the liability for anything, right? If for example, somebody chose to do something, let's say they ended up sending a message to somebody who was underage, right? That's really problematic, and that can literally get somebody sent to jail. That is absolutely true, especially if it's a sexualized message, you know. Am I responsible for them sending a sexualized message to someone under 18? Not exactly, but I am teaching them how to explore and express their sexuality. But do they even understand age? You know, does that person, I've worked with people who literally didn't understand age. And so trying to help them, our job is still to help people stay as safe and healthy and legal as possible, but we need to help them also. We need to recognize where their own limitations may be and where they may or may not understand things. And then our job is to teach them more, right? Not to say, oh, you just can't do that, or you can't go there, or you can't, you know, do this other thing. Our job is to teach them, like, here are the boundaries of what's legal and what's not. And here's what's going to be safe and healthy and you can explore and feel good about, and everybody's going to celebrate. And here are the things that have potential downsides, you know? And making sure that people make educated choices. But fundamentally, John, I'm an adult and I'm allowed to make my own choices. And so is every person with developmental diversity, right? And so it's really about giving information and making sure that they know as much as possible and then letting them make decisions.
How has COVID-19 interfered with your work?
You know, it's very interesting. I was on vacation when COVID-19 really shut our country down. And so when I came back from vacation, it was a whirlwind of a learning curve for me because I'd been gone for several weeks. But it definitely impacted, initially it impacted us because we just had to stop all of our trainings. We had to stop all of our services and just pause, you know. And then as we started to look at it, we started to transition most of our sessions with people, our interviews and our functional assessments and our positive behavior support plan work, we could transition fairly easily to online. So we did that. We also were right in the middle of having interns at the time. And so that was really complicated also because we had interns who were working with folks. And so we had to transition all of them too. But then pretty quickly, I think the biggest impact was definitely on trainings because we probably had to cancel 7 or 8 trainings in the first 2 months that I got back, you know, and because they were all live in-person trainings that we were going to be doing. And so we got on a very quick learning curve of figuring out how to do trainings online and offer them via things like Zoom or, you know, or GoToMeeting or that kind of thing. And so we're still figuring some of that out, but it's a lot easier than it was back then for sure.
Yeah, learning the new social media and how to connect with people has been quite the steep learning curve for me as well. And I only know Zoom and I need to learn the rest of it.
Yeah, and what I will say, John, that has been really hard is that I much prefer to meet in person. I much prefer to be present with people. I think this subject is hard enough on people to talk about. And then when you add the layer of now we have to talk about it through a computer, you know, that's a really frustrating piece about all of this because I think it makes it even less comfortable than it was before for many folks. So that's a really unfortunate piece. And I'm hoping as soon as we're able to, that we'll be able to do more of our interviews and stuff in person again, because I think that would be really meaningful.
Yeah, I must admit, an in-person is far better than staring at somebody across a TV screen.
Yes.
You just don't get, I don't know, there's just something about being in the same room, staring at a person's full body and their body language, I guess.
Yes.
And then, you know, people seem to interact from that. I mean, even if you don't pick up on body language very well, there still seems to be some kind of interaction that's just always more helpful if you're one-on-one someplace together. I mean, I don't suppose it doesn't have to be a room. It could be out in a park or wherever a person
right is. Right.
Comfortable. What are you presently advocating for? You do work with other individuals, and I'm kind of like wondering, are you talking to anybody and trying to advocate for something in the field or something like that?
Well, so let me give you kind of a picture of it. So for me, advocacy is at every level. So we advocate for individuals within their families, within their workplaces, within their schools. You know, we advocate on that level. On policy levels, we're advocating for organizations and companies to change their policies and to be more inclusive and to be more understanding and to see, you know, let's say, I'll tell you a funny story. There was a gal that I supported and she got a great new internship at a law firm, you know, through a friend of a family. And so she was really excited and the whole family was really excited for her. And, you know, 2 weeks in, they found her naked in the copy room waiting for the cute guy in the office. And so, you know, she didn't understand what the rules were. And so she made a major mistake, you know. And for me, I want to advocate for workplaces to use those as teaching opportunities instead of, hey, you're fired, you know, because I think it's so important because if somebody hasn't been taught, it's really harsh to say, well, now you've just lost a great job opportunity or you've just lost your housing or you've just lost your schooling or whatever because of one mistake that they weren't even taught about. You know, so I advocate for people on many different levels in those kinds of settings. In my trainings, I advocate for people to go back to their own agencies and change the policies there and make sure that they're including sexual health and healthy sexual development in their policies and in the way that they work with folks in this field. And also, I've been doing a train the trainer program with OHSU in partnership with OHSU. And one of the things that we do in one of the layers, one of the tiers of the program, is to have everybody write an advocacy plan of some sort. And so that can be, again, on the individual level, on a community level, on an agency level, or on legal law and policies, you know, for statewide or federal. And so my hope is to help, not only help those things happen, but inspire other people to do more advocacy in all those different levels. At least, you know, if I'm not currently able to help them, you know, specifically with whatever their project is.
Okay, so would it be okay to give out your contact information at the end of the show?
Absolutely. I'd be delighted if people wanted to contact us.
And you know what? I thought of a question, and I probably should have asked this a little bit earlier. So I apologize for bringing it up right now. But am I wrong in assuming that it's not just people with intellectual disabilities, but even the neurotypical people who could have problems with sexuality and the whole transgender and sexual education and the whole dating and everything else? So it's not just an intellectual disability problem. It's also a problem shared amongst, like, the neurotypical person, or just, you know, somebody who has a physical disability, or, you know, any type of person who, you know, even I guess the term asexual, if I've got that correctly,
mm-hmm.
Might have a problem with sexuality as well, maybe?
Well, maybe they're perfectly comfortable being asexual, and that's fine. But every type of person is going to run into issues that are troublesome around their relationships, their sexuality, and their bodies. Every single person on the earth is going to run into issues around those things. And so it is absolutely true that everybody's going to need some kind of support. It's just that when I decided to start to focus in on folks with developmental diversity, I decided that for me, that was a place where I could be extra helpful, because there aren't very many people providing those services. There are more people who can provide or do provide services to people who are neurotypical. And so for me, I just wanted to narrow in a little bit and be as helpful as I can in this community. And so that's meaningful to me.
In an ideal world, how would you like to see sexual services for people with disabilities work out?
Yeah, well, so many answers to that question. But what I fundamentally want for people is to live their full human experience and get to explore themselves and their bodies and their relationships and their connections in whatever ways feel meaningful to them. And so I can't promise myself to find a date, let alone can I promise anybody else to find a date. But what I can do is give people the skills and information and opportunities to find people to connect with, to be able to explore their own body when they have time by themselves, to be able to learn how to ask for consent when they are in a relationship, you know, so that they make sure that they are thoughtful in that connection with somebody else, to be able to honor boundaries and to honor their own boundaries and other people's boundaries. And what I can do is give people all the tools and skills. And then as they do meet people, they'll be better set up to be able to interact in ways that feel good to them and others. I would like to see any support workers be able to talk about sexuality and issues of, you know, bodies and relationships easily and without feeling awkward and, you know, afraid of talking about those things. I'd like for parents and families to be able to support the people that they love and to be able to talk about these things lovingly and with, you know, being able to talk about their family values, but also being able to recognize that the person that they are loving and supporting has legal rights and has, you know, their own experience in life to have. I would like to see policies at every level, from schools to cities to counties to, you know, states and the federal government, the federal government that allow people to explore with resources, you know, both funding and also opportunities and access to different options for themselves. And that is everything from, as I said earlier, somebody who might be transgender wanting to explore being able to change their gender, to somebody who might be looking to have, you know, a sexual surrogate or some other experience. And so I would want people to have all of those options. And I would want us to honor that in people. I would want us to express honor for that part of each person's life rather than being afraid of it or joking about it or being ashamed of it or any of that stuff, because I think it's so important to our health and well-being.
And would you call sexuality a basic human need?
I absolutely know that it is a basic human need, and all of the credible science and psychology and psychiatry information knows that it's a basic human need. And so it's not a question of whether it's a basic human need. It is a basic human need. And I even said in a training to some parents this last week, I said, it's also a biological drive. It's at the most basic level of our experience as a human. And so we can't ask people to stop it or ignore it. Like, that doesn't make any sense. Uh-huh. You know, what we have to do is support people to explore it in safe and healthy and legal ways, right? And all of the nuances and challenges that come with that.
I noticed that you said training for parents. Do you also train caregivers or PAs or case managers or anything else like that?
Yes, thank you for asking. I will train anybody on these issues. And I have a whole training menu if people want to contact us about that. I have a whole training menu of already created trainings, plus I can create custom material. So yes, absolutely.
And just out of curiosity, that training isn't necessarily just caregivers, but it could also possibly extend to somebody who's neurotypical as well?
Absolutely. I think that many of the trainings that I have created are generated towards someone who supports someone else in some way, because it's educating them if they don't know how to support somebody in these areas. But I've done trainings for individuals with developmental diversity, a whole group, many groups of folks with developmental diversity. I've done trainings for people who are neurotypical. I've had teachers in my trainings. I've had case managers in my trainings. I've had managers in my trainings. I've, you know, all different types of folks. And so I've had lots of parents come to a training that was sort of geared toward professionals. And so there's a lot of cross-learning that goes on, and it would be, I think, valuable for anybody who wants to learn some new things about these topics.
I have one last question for you.
Okay.
And what do you think are the steps that we need to take to make, to go in the right direction? Or how would you like to see the USA go into the right direction? You know, a lot less prudishism and a lot more acceptance on.
So my hope would be that we would have conversations about sexuality freely and often, that we would bring it up in as many different contexts as possible. My hope would be that we would change policies to be more inclusive and understanding, and that it would build bridges between people who see things differently rather than, you know, oh, you think that way and I think this way, so we can't talk, you know. I would hope that we would be able to support people with opportunities and access to resources so that they could explore their own experience of sexuality in whatever that means, and that we wouldn't dictate, oh, it has to look like this, or it has to look like that, or it has to be this other thing, you know? Because I do think you brought up asexuality earlier, and there are lots of people who don't even know what that is, you know? And so being able to teach people and explore things, but also make stuff a lot less shameful and make sure that we're not introducing or increasing people's shame around these topics, because it's so deadly. I mean, it literally is deadly. People kill themselves over not being able to, you know, say who they really are or, you know, express their love the way that they want to. And that's horrible. That's the last thing that should ever have to happen to somebody. And I love Dan Savage's movement, It Gets Better. Have you heard of that?
No, I haven't.
There's a whole movement trying to help people who are young and maybe are a part of a sexual or gender minority. It's a whole movement called It Gets Better, and it's testimonials from adults who are sexual gender minorities to talk to kids who might be feeling suicidal or in some other way, you know, ostracized from their families or their communities. And so it really is a beautiful thing that he's done to try to help reduce the suicide rates and, you know, and help get people support and help them feel optimistic and hopeful.
So do you mind if I get your contact information, please?
Sure. So my name is Shania Luther, and our business is called Among Friends. Our website address is among-friends.org. That's among-friends.org. And our phone number is 503-332-8783.
When somebody uses this contact, will they be getting a hold of you directly, or would they be getting a hold of somebody else?
Well, in this case, that is my phone number. I probably should give them the other phone number that has sort of a voicemail message in case they want to reach somebody if I'm in a training or something like that. Would you like me to share that one also?
Yes, please.
So that number is 503-832-0787. And that's the number that would have a voicemail message. And if even if I'm in a training or, you know, gone to do something for somebody, there's still people who check that voicemail message. So if people have a more generic question, they can certainly call that number.
All right. Thank you for doing the interview today. It's been very informative, and I hope to have you back again soon.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I really enjoyed being able to talk with you today too, John. So I appreciate you helping get the information out into the world.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
The Homelessness Marathon is America's only national radio broadcast focusing on homelessness and poverty. The Homelessness Marathon will air on Wednesday, December 9th.
I wish they would do something about getting people off the streets.
I'm not giving